It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Imagine Mexico without tacos or tamales. Imagine Mexican intellectuals trying to eliminate corn from the country where it was born. History professor Jeffrey Pilcher talks a national identity crisis. His book is Que Vivan Los Tamales, Food and the Making of Mexican Identity. Well, the Stearns have unearthed a new culinary identity for Tiverton, Rhode Island, the home of the chow mein sandwich. We have the new breakout herb from herb farm chef Jerry Traunfeld. It hails from Japan. Gourmet Magazine's John Willoughby is back from tracking the estancias of Argentina. And then it's eating his hard work. 5 days in Italy with Mario Battalion Gang. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Super Target. Well, today it's the story we never hear about Mexican cuisine. History professor Jeffrey Pilcher talks of a time when the taco and the tamale nearly disappeared. He's author of Que Vivan Los Tamales, Food and the Making of Mexican Identity. Herb Farm chef Jerry Traunfeld talks shiso, the next herb to get the spotlight. Gourmet magazine's John Willoughby reports on the best place in the world for protein high, ranches in Argentina. It's research eating in Italy with Mario Batali and his chefs. Only the stout-hearted need apply. Then we investigate New York's bakery with the secret name. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine.
Lynn, if you're driving along through Tiverton, Rhode Island, a beautiful place to drive, right by the shore, and you see Evelyn's Drive-In, you'll think, well, that's a kind of typical shoreline drive-in. And sure enough, in many ways it is. There are fried clams, lobster, scallops, you know, the whole lobster rolls. I mean, it's a great seafood menu. However, there is one item on the menu, and it's not prominently featured, but there it is on the menu that Jane and I could not resist. It's called a chow mein sandwich.
A what?
Yeah.
Wait a minute. We're talking noodles and all the vegetables and the stir fry and between a slice.
The between is the key word that doesn't belong. A chow mein sandwich is basically, it's a big plate of chow mein with a burger bun on top of it.
A hat?
Just kind of floated on top like a hat, exactly. And this makes it a chow mein sandwich. Now, the weird thing is, Evelyn's is not the origin of this. Chow mein sandwiches, we later learned, are popular all along the shoreline on east of Narragansett Bay, primarily because in 1936, a guy named Frederick Wong started the Oriental Chow Mein Company. And a genuine chow mein sandwich uses only noodles made by the Oriental Chow Mein Company in Fall River.
And so the company still exists.
Yes, it does. And it's run by his descendants. And the thing is, these noodles are really delicious. I mean, they're crunchy and delicious.
They're the kind
and
somehow that come they in the can, right?
But they're kind of frizzle fried under the hamburger bun. They do something. They do something to make the noodles not just out of the can. And they also make a gravy out of soy sauce and vegetables. And a hamburger bun on top of it.
How do you eat this thing?
With a fork. I mean, you do not pick this up like a sandwich. No, you use a fork.
See, my aunt, who was a Connecticut lady, always used to make what she called American chop suey, which has nothing to do with chop suey. It was ground beef and noodles and tomato sauce. So when we saw a chow mein sandwich on the menu in Rhode Island, I just assumed it was some weird Yankee version, you know, of noodles and ground beef, but it's not. And really, it is one of the lesser known American specialties, ethnic American.
Regional specialties,
regional
that's
ethnic
for sure.
American specialties.
And you do learn as you eat it, when you get to the bottom of the dish, because it really is delicious chow mein, that bun that you kind of push to the side really comes in handy to mop up the last of the gravy at the bottom of the dish.
Oh, so somebody was really thinking. I mean, there's a real intelligent use for the bun.
Yes, but why it's called a sandwich, I don't.
But what a curious... Yeah, that's the thing that's so interesting about what you guys do, though, because there's all these little pockets of dishes that nobody's ever heard of. Some of them, I must admit, as this is a bit bizarre, but a chow mein sandwich, I just can't imagine.
You have to try one.
It's all American. And for dessert, of course, being Rhode Island, you're going to have grape nuts pudding.
Well, of course you're going to have grape nuts pudding. What else would you eat in Rhode Island? Hey guys, thank you.
Ginger ice cream.
Or Indian pudding.
Or Indian pudding.
Hey guys, thank you.
Bye, Lynn.
The chop suey, chow mein, tofu in you. I got the craziest yen to get you in a Chinese den where I can whisper love words full of spice after we get full of tea and rice. So chop suey, chow mein, tofu in you. I got a feeling tonight that we'll be pretty clever if we ever get together with the chop suey, chow mein, rice and tea. Shoes and rice and you and me. The chop suey, chow mein, tofu and you.
Shane and Michael Stern are the authors of the freshly published Two for the Road. Now, you can hear the Sterns right here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, sign up for our weekly e-newsletter. Every week, we send you a quick worknight recipe, and we schmooze a bit about techniques and tips. But most of all, the goal is to make your worknight suppers easier. And the best thing is, weeknight kitchen's free. So sign up, splendidtable.org. According to herb expert Jerry Traunfeld, there is an herb poised on the brink of fame. Now, Jerry knows from whence he speaks. He's chef at the country's most acclaimed herbal restaurant, the Herb Farm, outside Seattle, and he experiments constantly. Jerry Traunfeld's latest book is The Herbal Kitchen, Cooking with Fragrance and Flavor. Jerry, welcome.
Hi, Lynn.
So, Jerry, what's this new herb poised on the brink?
Well, shiso is the Japanese name for an herb called perilla. And it's an herb in the mint family. It grows exactly like basil. It likes the hot weather. It's an annual. It's very, very easy to grow. And it has a very unique flavor. I guess if you had to describe it, picture in your mind a combination of cumin and cinnamon.
Ooh.
And maybe a little bit of parsley and a little bit of lemon. And all those flavors combined, to me, give me the flavor of shiso.
Is it powerful or is it very delicate?
It's quite strong. And it's sort of, for some people, it's an acquired taste. Not everybody loves it when they first taste it. But as you get accustomed to it, I think that it becomes a really delightful flavor. Most people are familiar with it from sushi bars because it's used in sushi rolls. Sometimes they'll put it in a roll with umeboshi, the pickled plums.
Oh, yes.
And
yeah.
Sometimes it's just used as a little garnish. It's used as a wrapper for shrimp or beef. It can be used with sashimi, or it's used a lot in pickling. And, you know, there's a red and a green shiso. And when you think of pickled ginger, it's pink.
Yes.
Well, traditionally, it was colored with the red shiso, which when you add it to a vinegar, kind of bleeds this beautiful pink color out. It's also used in other Asian countries, and the perilla is sort of a big family of herbs, and each Asian country kind of has their own variation of the plant. And so in Korean cooking, they use a perilla that in English it's sometimes called sesame leaf, but it does have a different flavor than the shiso we're talking about. It's also used in Vietnamese cooking, mm-hmm. and it also grows wild all over the Southeast. It sort of escaped. It's a very easy plant to grow. It self-seeds, and it's called rattlesnake weed in the Southeast, so that's how some people might know it.
How attractive. How attractive. I can't wait. It's just, but what does it actually look like? How can I identify the leaf?
Well, it does look like basil in a way, except it's a little more pointy. And there are different varieties of the herb. So some of them are green with a sort of a flat, pointy leaf with a wavy edge.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are a lot more crinkled and curly. And then the red is this beautiful, deep burgundy color. Sometimes it's called beefsteak plant because it has this really deep kind of ruddy red color. But the kind you get that's grown commercially and is used in sushi bars has a sort of a flatter green leaf. And you can often buy it where they sell Japanese ingredients. I think, though, it won't be long before we start seeing it more and more in supermarkets.
Now, if we want to use it in Western-style cooking, mm-hmm. some ideas?
Sure. Well, it's wonderful with in salads, so with summer vegetables, cucumber, tomato, avocado, green beans. And again, it's really the best use for shiso is to put it in vinegar. So you can make a wonderful vinaigrette with a little bit of the shiso to dress something like a tomato salad. It's also really nice with lamb because it has a sort of a similar quality to mint. So you can make like a little shiso pesto or a little rub for your lamb. And then I think the most wonderful use is with seafood, with fish, and especially with certain shellfish like crab. One of my favorite things to do is to make, I call it a shiso crab cocktail. You begin with a little bit of very finely diced red onion and seasoned rice wine vinegar. And you want to get the seasoned, which has sugar and salt in it. It's also called sushi vinegar sometimes. And so you combine those, you add some of chopped shiso leaves, mm-hmm. and you let that all sit for about half an hour. It kind of mellows the onion and the shiso flavor comes out better. And then you just toss in some beautiful fresh crab meat and some diced avocado, and then spoon it into a nice stemmed glass, and you have a beautiful little appetizer.
Do you all the things you seem to be talking about, the shiso isn't cooked into a dish. Is it always added mm-hmm. sort of at the end or used raw?
Almost always. The only exception would be sometimes it's used in tempura. And you can use either the leaf or traditionally the little seed heads or flower heads are used mm-hmm. in tempura. But, you know, when you cook it like that in the tempura, you really don't taste that shiso flavor as much. It really dissipates.
So you really want to use it raw and at the
right,
end of,
raw,
or at the end of a dish.
At the very end. Yeah. And that's why it's great in salads.
Mm-hmm. I've got to try this. Hey, Jerry, mm-hmm. thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Chef Jerry Traunfeld is author of The Herbal Kitchen, Cooking with Fragrance and Flavor. He left us with the ideal entry-level recipe, shiso crab cocktail. Find it on the website, splendidtable.org. Hey, I've got some wine news for you. The new edition of one of the better wine guides from Italy is out. Now, it's done by Gambero Rosso, and it's done in English and in Italian. Now, this group works with slow food, and they focus on artisan vineyards. Their top wine award is three glasses, tre bicchiere in Italian. Now, I've got the key winners from their best of list for the year. Now, by the way, you should know that not every one of these wines is going to be in local wine shops, but I wanted to tell you about them in case you run across a bottle. And don't worry about finding pencil and paper. I'm going to put this all up on the website. Okay? Now, best sparkling wine is by Bella Vista, and it's their Franciacorta Grand Cuvée Pas Opere 2000. Best white wine, the 2004 Collio Bianco Forcerin by Ronco de Tassi. Best red wine is from a vineyard called Molettieri, and the wine is their 2001 Torrasi Vigna Cinque Querce. Best priced wine is the 2004 Dolcetto di Dogliani Papa Celso by Abona. Check them out, guys, on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, a national cuisine under fire from its own people, feasting in the land of the gaucho, and eating up Italy with Mario Batali. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Our show is brought to you by SuperTarget, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You can find them online at target.com/SuperTarget. You know that old saw, show me what you eat, and I'll tell you who you are? Well, maybe. A country's culinary identity isn't as easy as that. Now, there's a book which raises some challenging questions. What is a national cuisine? Who creates it? And is it really about the place it comes from? Jeffrey Pilcher is an associate professor of history at the University of Minnesota. Now, he looks at Mexico's cuisine. I'm putting that in quotes. Now, his book is a story of identity conflict, the rub between how the Mexican government saw Mexico and how the people saw Mexico. The book is Que vivan los tamales, food and the making of Mexican identity. Jeffrey Pilcher, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So what is the significance of the tamale?
Well, the tamale is, of course, a corn dumpling that's wrapped in a corn husk and steamed. And corn is really Mexico's original domesticated crop and the foundation of their food. And tamales were their haute cuisine, their finest corn creation. And they made them with all kinds of different ingredients, everything from just simple beans and chili peppers to lobster tamales and duck meat tamales. And so they were really the foods you had for celebrations.
And you said that this corn technology, essentially the dried corn is cooked in a lime solution, which releases certain nutrients. But this goes back thousands of years, right?
Oh, sure. No one really knows when they first did this. And the nutritional importance, because if you don't cook it with this lime, and corn is the basis of your diet, you're
right,
subject to pellagra, this disease which causes all kinds of complications. And so no one really knows how they originally invented this idea of cooking it with basically a form of limestone, calcium oxide, but it became the basis for their diet.
So the Spaniards arrive, right? And then there's a conflict. The Europeans don't want the corn, right? They want wheat.
Right. Well, we have to remember that the corn was essential to the Native American religion, that they worshipped corn gods. And, of course, wheat was part of the Eucharist. It was the way in which
the Catholic communion
was held. And making the transition from corn to wheat was not just a matter of taste. It was religious evangelism, that if they were going to bring Christianity to the natives, they had to stomp out the corn gods and plant in the fields the wheat.
My way must be better than your way.
Absolutely.
Because I beat you. Amazing. Now, I'd like to do a fast forward to the early part of the 1900s. There's a revolution. We've seen movies. Viva Zapata. He was one of the great leaders. And this was an uprising of the peasants against essentially European rule, right? And it was this idea that the native of Mexico should gain dignity and power. But then something went wrong, and it was reflected in the food, or at least something went awry. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, of course, the Indians, in large part, were fighting to get back their cornfields, which were being used to grow export crops so that the Mexican elite could get richer. But when they grabbed their cornfields back, and the Mexican Revolution was successful, even though Zapata was murdered, they were able to overthrow the government. But the middle class in Mexico had their own ideas. And this is actually a common situation where, you know, as people kind of move up, as their status improves, they want to adopt what's trendy. And in this case, it was French food. French food represented, you know, the sophistication, the style that everyone wanted to be part of. And so there was a real conflict within the Mexican nation as what is the place of the Indian, first of all, but what is the place of the Indian food as well?
Were they ever beginning to take pride? Because you talk about cookbooks through the 1900s, through the last century, of essentially relegating local food to being indigestible. But that started to change, didn't it?
Yes, the 19th century was a time when everyone looked to Europe, and particularly France, and so French cuisine was the standard. But with the revolution, with this new indigenous identity, this new nationalism, which said that Mexico is a country with a tremendous Indian past, with great pyramids and great civilizations. And so corn then was suddenly recovered. I guess the person who was the foremost in this transformation was a woman named Josefina Velázquez de León, who was Mexico's version of Betty Crocker. She wrote more than 150 cookbooks.
Oh my.
Traveling all over Mexico.
And this is in the 20th century?
Yeah, she was. She wrote her most important book, which is the title is translated as The Regional Dishes of the Mexican Republic in 1946.
Huh.
And for the first time, all of the different regional foods from all over Mexico were brought together to create a national cuisine. And so for the first time, foods that had been scorned as the Indian food, tamales as something you wouldn't serve if you were a decent family, suddenly these foods came to be embraced as the national cuisine.
Jeffrey Pilcher, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Jeffrey Pilcher is Associate Professor of History at the University of Minnesota. He's author of Que Vivan Los Tamales, Food and the Making of Mexican Identity. John Willoughby is executive editor of Gourmet Magazine and an award-winning food writer. Now, this means he gets paid to check out local food scenes around the globe. He's just back from Argentina. Hey, John, welcome back.
It's great to be back, Lynn.
So, Argentina. Now, you know, I know all of Latin America is hot, but why specifically Argentina on this trip?
Well, when I was in high school, I spent a summer in Uruguay, and when I was there, one weekend went out to a farm where they butchered an entire cow and cooked the whole cow by leaning it on cross-like stands over a smoldering wood fire. It took all day. It was a huge celebration, and I loved it. It's called an asado, and we're doing an issue on cooking with fire, and I thought, you know, why not go down there and see if they're still doing that down there? Which, of course, they are. And so in order to find it, I went to Buenos Aires, and there's a lot of beef there. It really is true that beef is the national dish of Argentina and Uruguay. But we decided what we'd do is go out into the countryside to what are called the estancias. And what these are they're basically mansions that were built by the cattle barons in the 19th century. And it's very odd because you're on the pampas, which are these flat plains.
Right.
It's like driving through Iowa. All you see is grass and cows for hour after hour. And then suddenly in the distance, you'll see a mansion. I went to two, one of which was modeled after an Italian villa, and one of which was modeled after a Tudor mansion. So many of these now have been turned into sort of upscale bed and breakfasts. They all have spas, and you can go horse riding, and they have great food. And on Sundays, they have what's called the asado, the big barbecue.
And it's still done with that whole animal.
It is still done, although only rarely. Even when I was in Uruguay, which was quite a while ago, it was sort of a specialty, and of the gauchos, the cowboys, they would come and do it. It's kind of a big celebratory dinner. So they don't do it that often, but at the estancias, they usually do it on Sunday if they have enough people, which is why we went out there. And it really is, it's an amazing sort of culinary ritual. They have a lot of grills going all day. And the trick is, it's sort of like American barbecue, but they're really cooking over the flames and coals, not by indirect heat. So the trick is to keep it hot enough to cook it, but not so hot that it gets tough. And it really takes a lot of expertise. And it's served, it's not just, you don't get a steak.
Yeah.
You get three courses of beef. And the first course is always what we call the offal. You know, it's always intestines, always morcillo, which is blood sausage, always chorizo sausage, and usually kidney and liver as well. So you start out with that, and then when you're done with that, they bring you the second platter, and that's sort of the getting towards more tender cuts. They always have this cut called tira de asado, which is basically a flanken-style short rib.
Uh-huh.
Then you're likely to get flank steak and skirt steak in that course, and then they might also give you... Oh, skirt steak is my favorite steak.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, unbelievable.
And then
stuff.
They might also branch into a lamb chop, or they have this thing called a pamplona, which a lot of them are serving now, which is chicken or pork that they've stuffed with peppers, bell peppers, cheese, and bacon.
Mm.
So it's a very light meal. And then you go on from that. Then you get to the really tender cuts. You get a strip steak or a T-bone or a ribeye, and then you also get a thin strip of what we would call rump steak. So by the time you're finished with this, you've been eating beef for about 2 hours. And it's all very, very delicious. But the interesting thing about Argentinian cattle, it's all grass-fed. They don't fatten them up on grain at all. And I'm not really a fan of the grass-fed beef in the United States. It has a little sour taste to me. But
oh, really?
This is, yeah, I've never loved it here. But
so we have to talk about that later.
Because many people do, but it's just not been my favorite. But I love this. And it is not the kind of tender beef that we're that fond of here in the U.S. It's a little tough, a little chewy, but the flavor is amazing. It's deep and it's rich, and it has no kind of livery overtones. It's really just that full, deep beef flavor, which is, you know, I can't get enough of. Even 3 hours was about enough, I would say.
How are these things seasoned?
They put nothing on them but salt and pepper. It's really very straightforward. And then, well, the sausages, of course, they season. And actually, the morcillo, they have two kinds, which one is called dry, or you can have it wet, which means they put raisins and walnuts in it, which is, I love that. Because
it's
a
really old concept for blood sausage, too. It's like they call it pudding sometimes and that kind
of thing. Exactly. And it's in every single time, every barbecue and every meat restaurant we went to, you had blood sausage. So they just, but the regular cuts of beef, they just put salt and pepper on them. And then, of course, they serve every course with chimichurri, which is a sauce of parsley, olive oil, lemon juice. And some people put in shallots and chili peppers. But every course comes with that. And that's all. They serve a salad at the end, and they
roast boniatos. So you get something green eventually.
At the very end, and but there's very little thought put into the salad. Just kind of, oh, you know, here's some chopped up romaine, which is perfectly good, but it's not really not what the meal is about.
Interesting. Hey, John, thank you.
Thank you.
John Willoughby is executive editor of Gourmet Magazine. The Argentina story appears in the May 2006 issue of Gourmet. What most of us don't understand is that sometimes when you work in food, eating is like running a marathon, pure endurance, and only the champs stand a chance of surviving. Last year, Mario Batali went into chef research mode in preparation for opening a restaurant in New York. Mario took a handful of chefs back to the heart of his culinary inspiration, Italy's Emilia-Romagna region. Now, the logic here is that the only way that the chefs are going to know what he's after is by experiencing it themselves. Again, and again, and again. Writer Bob Sloan chronicled their five-day marathon.
July 2005. We have come to Bologna to eat. Not to see art and eat, or shop and eat, or wander beneath the ancient porticos unique to the city and eat. No, we are just eating. Our exercise will be walking from one restaurant to another. If there's a church on the way, we'll look up at it. Maybe. Otherwise, we are unwavering. Our Ahab is Mario Batali. Our crew includes three of Batali's chef cohorts and one intrepid reporter, who should have taken Batali's advice and stopped eating a week before the trip. At the end of our 5 days, we will have eaten 62 courses, not counting desserts. A glorious and terrifying amount of food. Day one. Lunch begins 15 minutes after we arrive. Why wait? We sit at an outdoor table at the lovely Trattoria Caminetto d'Oro, established in 1927. A Prosecco is poured. I hope everyone is feeling good about themselves, Batali says, because by our last meal, you won't be. We warily raise our glasses. Chin chin. This toast will become our battle cry, periodically rallying any of us who have gone timid in the face of another meal. Our antipasti are placed in front of us. Immediately, like an old man in prayer or a kid studying a toad, each chef hunches over his food, his nose mere inches away. The group breathes in deeply, then everyone lifts his head and smiles. Only then do we begin to eat. Some prosciutto has passed my way. This is about the best prosciutto I've ever tasted, I venture boldly. Oh, that's not prosciutto, Zach Allen says. Zach is our salami and cured meat expert. It's culatello, made from the heart of the back leg. What is it, Mario, a 300-day cure? 300 days, Batali confirms. It's soaked in white wine first. It's not that I feel stupid, just magnificently quotidian. I have discovered via culatello, and it will be reconfirmed many times over the next 5 days, that chefs do not eat like normal people. Nothing escapes the group's scrutiny. Day two. We take a 30-minute train ride to Modena to eat at Osteria Giusti, an eight-table restaurant attached to a 400-year-old salumeria. When we arrive, the shop is closed, the gate half shut. Batali disappears underneath. From within, joyful cries, Mario! The gate opens. Bottles of wine line one wall of the tiny salumeria. Salami, cured guanciale, and prosciutto line the other. Adriano Morandi shows off his mortadella the way a kid would his new bike. I make it now with more honey, Mario. He cuts a piece, holds it out to me, pinned on an imposing knife. A cork pops. Morandi's Lambrusco. It's unfiltered, Mario. He pours. We hold up our glasses to see the transition from clarity to cloudiness. Chin chin. We head into the back room for lunch. In the dining room, under ancient oak beams, five tables have been gathered together for us alone. Something magical is about to happen. Here are the highlights from our eight courses, not including dessert, at Osteria Giusti. Gnocco Fritto, a triangular dough puff, warm and savory, served with a slice of melting gorgonzola. Next, two courses featuring squash blossoms, one fried, the other a frittata, topped with a 50-year-old balsamic vinegar. Then two pastas. First, a perfect tortellini, then garganelli with duck ragu. Then cold pork prepared like tuna, served with warm roasted torpedo onions and graced with an even older balsamic. And finally, stewed guanciale, veal cheeks. Like synchronized swimmers, we all take a bite and then in unison set our forks down, look at each other, and laugh. We have just tasted one of the best things we have ever eaten, and we are too full to finish. Dinner that night at Trattoria Battibecco is somewhat disappointing. The decor is tasteful, but after Giusti it seems slightly pretentious. Perhaps any restaurant would. Battibecco specializes in fish from the Adriatic, and after so much meat, some fish is welcome. In fact, one of us, I will not say who, it wasn't me, orders a salad as his secondo. We mock him ruthlessly. Maybe they have some tofu and mashed yeast to go with it, we say. Still, the quiet at the table suggests maybe we are all thinking about that salad. Day 3. We travel an hour by car to Ristorante Per Bellini, a Michelin 2-star located off the Superstrada in a kind of industrial park. Per Bellini is our contemporary eating experience, but today there is much grumbling. Over 8 courses, there are remarkable flavors, beautiful presentations, but we are disheartened by the disconnect we sense between the countryside and the food. We are dazzled, but strangely unmoved, as if we were looking at a painting that, even if well executed, was chosen solely because it matched the color of the couch. It is a good lesson. That afternoon, we stumble upon a charming gelateria. Inside, the owner has his sleeves rolled up and is teaching his son to work the handsome gelato machine. An exquisite young woman delicately assembles a cone by shaping the gelato into a flower, strawberry-flavored in the center and sweet cream petals. I order one of the same. This is everything I love about Italy, the craftsman father, the apprentice son, the luminous girl behind the counter, all coalescing around the luxuriant flavor of authentic gelato. Smiling, I emerge from the shop with my gelato flour and spoons to share. "Did you see that machine?" Alan asks. "Cool, wasn't it?" I say, "kind of deco." "It's the French pot method. The gelato has to be scraped by hand as it freezes." I offer Alan a taste. His face clouds ominously. "I think they use a base."
"A base?"
"They first make a vanilla and chocolate base," he says, "then add other flavors to it."
"That's bad?"
He shrugs. Clearly it's not good. He takes another bite. "Definitely a base." I look at my gelato. In another more innocent time, I would have savored it. Now, older, wiser, and with a heavy heart, I toss the base-tainted French method cone into the garbage.
Bob Sloan's article, Travels with Mario, appeared in the April 2006 issue of Gourmet Magazine. Bob is the author of the Tailgating Cookbook. Mario's restaurant, Del Posto, opened in New York City in January 2006. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge, and it's about Italy, kind of. The question is, what was the quartet of Annona, Penantes, Forculus, and Cardia responsible for? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. It's Target, now available in food, where you can find the expected and unexpected aisle after aisle. Online at Target.com/SuperTarget. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. And the question, well, it was kind of silly, but here it was. What was the quartet of Annona, Penates, Phorcalis, and Cardia responsible for? Well, they were kitchen gods and spirits of ancient Rome, and things really got specific back then. Annona was the mythical personification of the food supply. Penates were the household spirits of the cupboards where the food was stored. Phorcalis was the god of the cupboard doors. And Cardia was my favorite, the goddess of door hinges.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me.
It's time for your call, so pick up that phone. The number's 800-537-5252. Okay, let's see. Who is on the line? We have got Jeanette from Twin Valley, Minnesota. Hey, Jeanette, what do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about tasting summer after a long winter.
Oh, I'm with you.
I am hoping that you can give me an idea for something fresh and delicious and different to do with lemons.
Oh, yeah. You know, I always think of them as sort of, even though they're around all winter and they're in great shape right now, especially, I always think of them as the first taste of spring. You know, it's this, I guess it's because I think of things like, you know, new asparagus with just a squeeze.
A little bit of lemon on it.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, something that's going to taste fresh and bright. Well, you know, can we talk dessert for a minute?
Oh, certainly.
Yeah, because there is a real old-fashioned lemon ice cream recipe that I put on the Splendid Table website. And I think it's just called Lynn's Stirred Lemon Ice Cream. And I don't remember where I got this recipe. I've been making it for gosh knows how long. And it's I think it originally came from the days, there were crank ice cream makers, but essentially people made ice cream in ice cube trays. And they would just stir it, you know, as the ice crystals would form along the edges. They'd take it out of the little freezer in the very old refrigerators, and they'd just stir it, and then they'd put it back in. And what it is it's lemon juice, lemon zest, sugar, and cream.
Ooh.
And that's it. And it's not, you know, this is not Ben and Jerry's, but it is so good. It's so wonderfully old fashioned. And when you serve it with the first strawberries, serve it on its own, it would be wonderful. But, you know, I use it all summer long, and it starts with the first strawberries in spring, and then it goes from there. But what might be fun to gussy it up a little would be to make it, but then to also take paper thin slices of fresh lemon and poach them in sugar syrup, essentially almost candy them. Have you ever tried this?
No.
Well, it's really interesting because, you know, you get the bitter part of the rind, the white part, right?
Right.
So this is the deal. What you do is you paper thin slice the lemon. You drop in a little boiling water for about 5 minutes. You drain it. And then you make a sugar syrup of, let's say, 2 parts sugar to 1 part water. And you gently cook the lemon in that. And when you can see through it, it's candied. And it's still going to have that bitter edge, but it would be so nice to have snippets of that over the top of the lemon ice cream.
Well, that sounds wonderful.
Doesn't that sound like it would really be fun?
Yes.
You know, just really bright and fresh. And if you wanted to gild the lily further, I'd finish it with a squeeze of fresh lemon juice, just from a half a lemon. I think you'd get all these different levels of really good lemon taste. So that's one way to go. And I think, well, lemon and fish, you know, it's an old trick, but boy, it works. Line the bottom of a baking dish with thin slices of lemon and lots of sliced garlic. Just do it in the food processor. And if you want some fresh herbs, perhaps rosemary or thyme, and then slather whatever whole fish you want to make that is not super duper delicate. I mean, this is with salmon, this will make you die and go to heaven. Slather it with olive oil, sprinkle it with coarse salt. If it's a whole fish, stuff more lemon slices in the center. and then do a very slow bake on that. Do that in a 300-degree oven. And you want to do it until when you just make a little cut into the fish is opaque to the bone. Don't take it any further than that. But that lemon base will perfume the fish. And then just serve that fish with wedges of fresh lemon right on the platter. It's utterly simple.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
And wouldn't that be wonderful? And then you'd serve some fluffy rice with that you might spoon some of those juices onto and squeeze with fresh lemon juice again.
That sounds really good.
Yeah, I think you'd have a lot of fun with this because, you know, the thing with lemon is that in one sense, when you cook the juice, for instance, to make a custard or whatever, it changes. It's good, but it changes. But this way, always keep the bright flavor of the fresh lemon to finish off the dish, and it'll be just wonderful.
Great. Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks for a great call. You take care.
You too. Bye.
Bye. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. There is one other thing to do with lemons, and if you can find lemons that have thin skins, there's an old recipe from the Shakers. It's called Shaker Lemon Pie, and you thin slice maybe 4 or 5 lemons, and I mean paper thin, and you essentially toss them with lots of sugar and let them sit overnight. And then with the juice, the sugar's going to draw juice out of that lemon, you make a custard with eggs, and you put that between two crusts of a really good pie crust, and you bake it. And you get a little bite from the rind, but it is unbelievably good. Unbelievably good. The Shakers were incredible cooks. Call us, 800-537-5252. We have Bianca up from Wichita. Bianca, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I have this problem with making any sort of fried cake, like rice cakes or salmon cakes.
Yeah.
And they always fall apart, and I can't figure out what I'm doing wrong.
Well, tell me what you're doing.
In general, I usually add breadcrumbs.
Right.
Some sort of moisture, like a mustard or a mayo or an oil.
Right.
And I've tried with eggs or without eggs, and I just can't get them to stick together, ever.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay. Methinks you're probably not using enough of the egg or and some kind of maybe a bit of fat. Let me give you an instance, okay?
Okay.
I think of crab cakes because that's one of the prime, you know, cakes.
Yeah.
But once you can use the formula of a crab cake anywhere.
Okay.
And if you, let's say you're going to do it with mayonnaise, The formula works something like this. If you have got, let's say, 12 ounces of whatever your main ingredient is,
okay.
3/4 of a pound, okay? You'd want 1/3 to 1/2 cup of mayo, all right?
Okay.
And you'd want about 1/2 cup of really fluffy breadcrumbs, or you could use something like saltines.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And then, you know, any kind of flavorings you want. You could use mustard and Tabasco. You could throw in, you know, celery or whatever. But that mayo and one egg, blend that together with whatever seasonings you've got. Then what you do is you gently fold in the breadcrumbs or the crackers, okay?
Okay.
Crackers are a great trick, by the way, because they still have a little crunch to them.
Yeah.
And then 3/4 of a pound or so of whatever you're making. And see how that holds together. And then the other trick to it is that with cakes, when you pat them together, chill them.
Oh.
Yeah.
I never do that. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing is roll them in flour and dust off the excess. That's how you'll get them crisp on the outside. And you slow cook them, you know, because they're going to be cool inside and you want to get all that stuff cooked. You know, you want it the medium to medium high. You don't want to do it over super duper high heat.
Okay.
So you let them go. Some people even bake them.
Okay.
But that's the mayo formula. And then there are the other formulas like 2 eggs to 1/4 cup of cream. And you'd use that for about 12 ounces of stuff.
Huh, okay.
Okay?
Yeah, thanks so much.
So see how that works for you.
I will. And Lynn, I love your show.
Hey, thank you.
Love it.
And thanks for calling.
Oh, absolutely.
You take care, Bianca.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Okay, we've got Ken calling from Pittsburgh. Hey, Ken, what do you want to talk about?
Hey, Lynn. My roommates and I, we're college students, and this is our last year, and we're just looking for healthy organic lunches that we can pack up and take with us to campus so we're not spending, like, you know, ungodly amounts of money on fast food.
Yeah, exactly. What do you like? What do you guys like to eat?
One of my roommates is vegan, so he's been eating mostly beans and greens and stuff like that.
Right.
I eat pretty much anything. I like sandwiches a lot.
You know, I've got an idea. I was just talking to somebody about this. I'm yearning to go back to the south of France for, you know, the sun and the olive oil and all of that.
Yeah.
There's a sandwich, and it has a lot of different versions. It's called pan baguette, which really means wet bread. Very romantic. Don't have it translated for anybody. But this is the idea. You take a roll of really good, chewy bread, and if it's whole grain, all the better. All right? Okay. You open it up, pull out some of the stuff inside of it, sprinkle it with olive oil, rub it with garlic first, sprinkle it with olive oil. If you don't want the garlic because you're socializing, you know, don't bother. But the idea is salt and pepper. And then what you would do is you'd put in things like sliced sweet onion, lots of dark greens because they're going to really be healthy and they're not going to be wildly expensive. You could crush some chickpeas and put that in.
Oh, okay.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Fresh coriander. And then, I mean, you could do tuna fish, which is one of the traditions. Oh, you put in olives, pitted olives. You could put in bits of tomato, you know, fresh peppers. The idea is, oh, cucumber, always cucumber. And it's like making a salad and putting it in a sandwich.
Okay.
So you've got olive oil on the bread. You can sprinkle a little lemon juice or vinegar over everything. So do you see what I'm saying, though? It's whatever you have. You could do some grains in there. If you have leftover cooked barley with the chickpeas, it would be fabulous. And then what you do is you wrap that and you really press it. And it's the easiest thing to eat. It's utterly delicious. And you can change it every time you go, you know, every time you make it.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Now, the other thing, soba noodles, Japanese buckwheat noodles.
What is it, soba?
So, S-O-B-A.
Okay.
You can find them in Asian markets. They're not wildly expensive. I'm thinking cheap here. That's why I'm going for the for the healthy starches. You know, that's where I'm starting because they're going to fill you up. They're good for you. And with that, you could do a really spicy peanut dressing. So
oh
you use chunky peanut butter and chili and a little bit of brown sugar and garlic and ginger and even a little bit of soy sauce and a little bit of sesame oil.
Yeah. Oh,
you follow that? Now, with that, you could do oriental greens. You could do bean sprouts. You could do all kinds of, you know, Asian vegetables. And you're home free. If you want to add, like, you know, the leftover chicken or the bits and pieces of some kind of meat or fish, you could too. It would be no problem. But that holds in the refrigerator. And you're going to just, you can, I mean, we used to live on that. It was just so good.
That's awesome. Yeah, thank you.
Hey, enjoy.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Take care.
You too.
A bakery opened in New York City with a weird approach to marketing. No name on the door. When you ask the people who work there what it was called, they'd tell you it was a secret. And when you asked who was doing the sensational baking, still a secret. Well, New York Magazine blew the baker's cover, exposing pastry star chef Maury Rubin of City Bakery as No Name's creator. Now, we have Maury on the phone. Maury, welcome.
Hi. Nice to be here, Lynn.
So, Maury, what's going on? What is this about?
Well, it was about a little project that had, for my part, my interest in environmental initiatives and City Bakery being a small company, that always tried to do well by the environment, mm-hmm. and I wanted to do that in a new format besides just calling it City Bakery.
So what did you actually create? Can you describe the place for us?
We built a tiny retail bakery that is top to bottom green, sustainable, recyclable, biodegradable, vintage, or found materials so that, for example, the walls are made out of a wheat board. It's actually the byproduct of making wheat is turned into a composite board. One wall is made out of something called Dakota burl, which is the remains of sunflower seeds. There's some amazing stuff happening in building materials these days in the sustainable realm. So
this is so perfect for a bakery to have the walls made out of wheat and then seed.
You know what? It was one of those things where I'm looking around the web, and I'm looking up for, you know, I'm looking for materials, and you come upon walls that are made of wheat, and it's a pretty exciting moment. Yeah.
I could hear light bulbs just flashing,
right,
and going off. So what else? Give me more of a picture.
The floor is cork. The tables are bamboo. The space, the actual space that we moved into, was a little old, I would say a classic New York neighborhood bread bakery. It was an Italian bread bakery. We made one wall out of the bread boards that they used to bake with. The table itself is recycled denim that's intended for insulation of homes. And I actually use that as the base of the whole table. So basically, it's about 95% of what the bakery is made of, whether it's bamboo or cork. The staff uniform is custom made from hemp and linen seed, wheat board, sunflower seeds. That's what this place is made of, top to bottom.
Well, why no name?
I wanted people to concentrate on the materials. You know, City Bakery has a reputation that's a great reputation in New York.
Right.
And I knew if I put City Bakery's name on the door that people would walk in and the first question they would ask is, where's the pretzel croissant or why don't you have the hot chocolate? And I wanted to give this project its own identity, and I wanted it to have a chance to have people come to it and understand it for, this is yummy pastry, but this is also this other thing, and it's got this other meaning.
Concept, almost.
Right.
So have you been busy?
Oh, we've been very busy. Better than being busy, I think that we've really touched a very wonderful nerve with people. I think there's been this great response. I think people who come in who see cookies in the window and come in thinking, I want a cookie, they walk out talking about sustainable building materials. And that's been very gratifying.
Well, Maury, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Maury Rubin is pastry chef and creator of City Bakery, both in L.A. and New York, and the No Name Place. Now, for more information, go to the website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number's 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this quote from Irma Bombeck. She said, seize the moment. Remember all those women on the Titanic who waved off the dessert cart. The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Now, everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's our attempt to simplify your kitchen life midweek. Register for it online, you know where, splendidtable.org. Hey, and now you can also download our weekly podcast, Kitchen Questions. You can take me with you to the gym or the grocery store. You'll find it on the website. Simply click on podcast. Our producers are Sally Swift and Jennifer Russell with help from Janelle Sorensen. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham, Julia Schrankler, and Jeff Harkness. Have a great week. Be sure to join us next time. And thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.